Okay, so we'll begin the second day session with a paper on the analysis of experience in classical Sankhya by Michael Burley, who is in the Department of Philosophy and of Theology and Religious Studies at Leeds.
Thank you very much. Sankhya philosophy is well known for its enumeration of categories. Indeed, when a single English equivalent to the term Sankhya is sought, enumeration is often considered to be among the most viable candidates. Not all commentators on Sankhya have regarded its liking for enumeration as a virtue, however. Arthur Schopenhauer, for example, remarked in the 19th century that a peculiar feature of pedantry and narrowness in the Sankhya is the system of numbers, the summation and enumeration of qualities and attributes. He added, however, that this appears to be customary in India, for the very same thing is done in the Buddhist scriptures. Had the relevant texts been available to him at the time, Schopenhauer could also have added, perhaps Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Kashmir Shaivism, and many others to this list of putative pedants. The best known of Sankhya's enumerated categorical systems is its system of 25 categories, beginning with the two co-fundamental principles, Purusha and Prakriti, and unfolding into a series of 23 further principles, which together constitute the manifest or vyakta aspect of Prakriti. Sankhya's classical text, the Sankhya Karika, contains two other categorical systems, namely the Pratyaya Sarga and the Bhautika Sarga. The first of these comprises 50 psychological states or dispositions, and the second is a schema of three domains of beings: divine, natural, and human. I will make no further reference to this latter schema in this paper, and just one reference to the Pratyaya Sarga, the main object of my discussion being the series of 23 categories designated in the Sankhya Karika as the Krita Sarga, literally the creative surge or creative emergence. The interpretation of the Sankhya categories remains a matter of contention. Rodney Parrott sets up the contested issue as follows. Out of its intense observation of the world comes what classical Sankhya is most famous for, the categorization of cosmic creation into 23 essences, tattvas. Purusha and unmanifest Prakriti make 25. The whole cosmology of Sankhya finds its foundation on these essences. Yet a deep confusion has existed among scholars who have attempted to interpret the essences. The state of affairs has come about because the Karika presents the essences as both cosmic and psychological phenomena. Leaving aside Parrott's questionable choice of essence as a translation of tattva, the above passage usefully identifies a central issue for interpreters. This is the issue of whether the 25 categories are best understood in cosmic terms as a kind of cosmogony or creation story, or alternatively in psychological terms. It is this issue with which my paper is chiefly concerned. What I'll aim to do is the following. Firstly, I'll outline some of the ways in which a number of scholars have gone about interpreting the Sankhya categories. And I shall suggest that these ways tend to lead to difficulties or confusions. I'll propose that there are two major presuppositions that generate problems here. One of these is that the relations between the 23 categories are in some sense, that in some sense derive from Prakriti, are diachronic, or in other words, temporally sequential. The other presupposition is that if a psychological interpretation is to be made, then the system of categories must be construed as an account of the relations of material causality between psychological faculties, and it's far from clear what this could even mean, to me at least. Having highlighted some difficulties with these assumptions, I shall then at least begin the task of setting out an alternative interpretation. I'll not be claiming any substantial originality here, but will endeavour to elaborate a line of thought suggested by a few previous interpreters. This thought is that Sankhya's system of 23 manifest categories is best understood as an analysis of experience, as opposed to a cosmogony or an account of psychological faculties. obvious starting point for any discussion of the Sankhya categories is its distinction between Purusha and Prakriti. As stated by Roy Perrett, not to be confused with Rodney Parrott, who I quoted before, it is uncontroversial that Sankhya Yoga is a kind of metaphysical dualism. It posits just two fundamental categories of reality, Purusha, self, consciousness, and Prakriti, nature, or matter. While this characterization may indeed be uncontroversial, it remains so only if we abstain from closely examining its significant terms. Once we begin to ask what is meant by a metaphysical dualism, or by terms such as self, consciousness, nature, and matter, then controversy is apt to emerge. An approach adopted by some interpreters is to define Sankhya dualism by contrasting it with the kind of dualism that we find in early modern Western philosophy, most notably the substance dualism associated with René Descartes. As Gerald Larson observes, if one looks at the classic expression of the dualist position in Western thought, namely that of Descartes, one realizes immediately that the Sankhya somehow misses the mark. By this, Larson does not mean that Sankhya dualism misses the mark for being a dualism. He means simply that it is not to be equated with Cartesian dualism. In an earlier article, Larson writes that in classical Sankhya, the fundamental dualism is that between individual consciousness on the one hand and the unconscious world on the other. The Sankhya dualism is not a dualism of mind and body, or a dualism of thought and extension. Roy Perrott also denies that the Purusha-Prakriti dualism is well described as a mind-body dualism, but unlike Larson, he prefers to characterize it as a consciousness-mind dualism. While it is certainly important to distinguish Sankhya's dualism from that of Descartes, it is also important not to characterize it in terms that risk being equally misleading. And it is questionable whether this latter risk is avoided by designating Purusha as consciousness and Prakriti either as the unconscious world, as Larson does, or as mind, as Perrott does. The designation of Prakriti as the world is linked with the popular identification of Sankhya as realist, whereas its designation as mind is based on an acknowledgement of the obviously psychological nature of several of the categories that constitute Prakriti's manifestation. Each designation faces problems, and so does the underlying assumption that Sankhya is indeed realist. The latter assumption often goes hand in hand with the assumption that the sort of realism that is relevant here is realism about the material world of perceptible objects. Such a conjunction of assumptions is exemplified by Richard King's remark that Sankhya upholds a thoroughgoing realism. The world around us is real and independent of our perception of it, being a series of material evolutes, parinama, deriving from Prakriti. Descriptions of this sort are liable to be misleading, for they might be taken to imply that Prakriti's manifest aspect encompasses exactly what Cartesian dualism designates as extended substance, and hence the Prakriti itself is the matter out of which the world of spatially extended and temporally enduring objects is formed. Even Perrott, in the very article where he characterizes the Purusha-Prakriti dualism as a dualism of consciousness and mind, says of Prakriti that it is a unitary material substance which evolves into the world we perceive through our senses. From this interpretive position, according to which Prakriti is or evolves into the world of material objects that we perceive through our senses, it becomes very difficult to accommodate obviously psychological categories within an overall account of Prakriti. In particular, it becomes difficult to accommodate such categories as buddhi, ahankara, and manas. Interpreters thus often resort to stipulating that what they mean by terms such as matter and material is not what these terms typically mean when applied to Cartesian dualism. Yet it tends to be precisely the Cartesian categories of a mental realm of thoughts and perceptions on the one hand, and a mind-independent world of material objects on the other, that are implicitly invoked in order to spell out the version of realism that Sankhya is purported to uphold. As I've mentioned already, one way of formulating the interpretive difficulty pertaining to the series of 23 manifest categories is as the difficulty of determining whether these categories are cosmological or psychological. I earlier quoted Bodney Parrott's diagnosis that a deep confusion has existed among scholars owing to the fact that the Sankhya-Karika, quote, presents the tattvas as both cosmic and psychological phenomena. In a similar vein, Richard King writes that, quote, an interesting feature, sorry, I don't have this quote on the slide, an interesting feature of the Sankhya scheme is the way in which it can be interpreted both in psychological and cosmological terms. End quote. This way of putting the point differs slightly from Parrott's in the following way. While King acknowledges that whether the categories are understood as in cosmological or in psychological terms is a matter of interpretation, Parrott could be taken to mean that the cosmological and psychological readings are somehow already present in the text prior to any interpretive work. This, however, would be to beg the interpretive question. As interpreters and students of the Sankhya-Karika, we need to ask ourselves how it is best understood. And although this may well involve asking whether it is best understood in cosmological or psychological terms, or perhaps in some other terms, we should acknowledge that our seeing the text as presenting the categories as both cosmological and psychological, as Parrott suggests, is already to be interpreting it. The Sankhya-Karika nowhere explicitly indicates that the 23 manifest categories are best understood in cosmological terms. The fact that it is often read as a cosmogony or creation story is a consequence of the form in which the series is presented, rather than of its content. In particular, the way in which the 22nd verse of the Sankhya-Karika introduces the series indicates that relations of dependency obtain between different members of the series. In other words, one thing is said to be in some sense responsible for the existence or coming into being of another thing, and that second thing is in turn responsible for a third, and so on. In Sanskrit, Sankhya-Karika 22 reads, Prakriter mahans tato hankaras tasmad ganashcha shodashakaha tasmad api shodashakat anchakyaha pancha bhutani. And the relations between the categories can be represented diagrammatically like so. This ordering of the categories is uncontentious. The important question is how the arrows in this diagram are to be explicated conceptually. Because the salient relationships are indicated in the Sanskrit by the use of the ablative case, most translators of the text opt for a rendering that implies relations of diachronic material production or causation. Consider, for example, the following translations in which I've highlighted the key relational terms. Ganganatha Jha's translation reads, from Prakriti issues Mahat or Buddhi, from this Mahat again issues self-consciousness, Ahankara, from which proceeds the set of 16, from five of these 16 proceed the five gross elements. Surya Narayana Shastri's translation reads, from primal nature proceeds the great one, or intellect, thence individuation, thence the aggregate of the 16, and from five out of these 16 the five gross elements. Gerald Larson's translation reads, from Prakriti emerges the great one, Mahat, from that comes self-awareness, Ahankara, from that comes the group of 16, moreover, from five of the 16 come the five gross elements. Possibly a more exegetically neutral rendering, which admittedly is not a full translation, might leave out the parentheses that Larson includes there and read, from Prakriti, Mahat, from that, Ahankara, and from that, the 16. From five of those 16, the five Bhutas. Even in the case of this latter rendering, however, one might reasonably suppose that verbs such as issues, proceeds, emerges, or comes remain implicit and will be naturally filled in by the reader. If this is so, then perhaps there is no scope for denying that the text invites a reading of Procrates' manifestation as comprising a diachronic, or in other words, temporally successive series. This alone does not compel us to construe the series as a cosmogony, but it is not difficult to see how taking this further interpretive step will appear attractive, especially in view of the fact that it is the immediately preceding Karaka, number 21, that the conjunction of Purusha and Pradhana is declared to be, or give rise to, a creative emergence. Pradhana, of course, being a synonym of Prakriti. What follows Karaka 22, however, is a series of Karakas, numbers 23 to 38, in which many of the manifest categories are concisely characterised in ways that make a psychological reading far more plausible than a cosmological one. Consequently, most interpreters understand mahat or buddhi to be an intellectual faculty, ahankara to be a faculty of self-awareness or egoity, manas to be the mind or faculty of thought, and the buddhindriyas to be the five sense modalities. In the case of the karmendriyas, tanmatras and bhutas, meanwhile, these are commonly translated as action capacities, subtle elements and gross elements respectively. And in the case of the last two of these, they are typically construed as features or constituents of the physical world that exists independently of psychological factors. This latter point builds attention into standard interpretations, since it is unclear how the tanmatras and bhutas can be ontologically dependent on psychological faculties, given that the bhutas derive or emerge, I'm not sure whether I read that right, can be ontologically independent of the psychological faculties, given that the bhutas derive or emerge from the tanmatras, and the tanmatras in turn derive or emerge from ahamkara. If ahamkara is admitted to be psychological, then the conclusion cannot be avoided that the tanmatras and bhutas are, if not psychological categories themselves, at least ontologically dependent on psychological categories. Commentators on Sankhya, whether traditional or modern, rarely devote much attention to this apparent incongruity and typically mention the derivation of the tanmatras without pausing to explain how, if these are objective features of the world, they can intelligibly be said to derive, emerge, or emanate from ahamkara, when the latter is understood to be the psychological faculty of self-awareness or egoity or something of that kind. Of those modern commentators who have recognised that there is a problem here, some have tried to tackle it by positing a twofold conception of manifest property, according to which, for each of the terms in the series of 23 categories, there is both a cosmological and a psychological category. Sarvapalli Radhakrishnan exemplifies this position when he writes as follows. Buddhi, as the product of Prakriti and the generator of ahamkara, is different from buddhi, which controls the processes of the senses, mind and ahamkara. If the former is identified with the latter, the whole evolution of Prakriti must be regarded as subjective, since the ego and the non-ego are both the products of buddhi. This ambiguity is found in the other products of Prakriti also. Thus, having apparently precluded in advance the possibility that the whole evolution of Prakriti may indeed be in some sense subjective, Radhakrishnan instead prefers to duplicate each of the categories. He thereby provides an interpretation that is at once textually unwarranted and extremely ontologically unparsimonious. More recently, Ian Witcher has adopted a version of this duplicating strategy, with the exception that, on his view, it is only the cosmological categories that are ultimately real. The psychological categories are held by him to be the products of an individual's falsely identifying himself or herself with the cosmological ones. It would be a grave mistake to assert, claims Witcher, that the cosmic and individual buddhi, for example, have the same ontological status. Personal intellects are not generated from Prakriti in the real causal process, but are created when the Prakritic sense of self he imagines or conceives Mahat to be the locus of authentic identity. Witcher does not explain what he means by prakritic sense of self, but a reasonable interpretation would be that he is referring to Ahankara, for it is this latter term that is rendered as sense of self in the index to Witcher's book. This makes his account confusing, however, for it now seems that buddhi as a personal intellect can be created only through the conceptual activity of Ahankara, yet the creation of Ahankara is itself generally agreed to be dependent on buddhi. Witcher's account thus gets the dependency relation between buddhi and Ahankara the wrong way round. And in any case, there remains no textual justification for positing two ontologically distinct versions of each of the manifest categories. It should be noted that the way in which the Samkhya categories are interpreted has implications for the coherence of Samkhya as a philosophical and soteriological system. For if we cannot see how the manifest categories themselves are related to one another, it will remain obscure how their systematic enumeration in Samkhya Karika is of any relevance to the soteriological goal that classical Samkhya shares with classical yoga, this goal being termed Kaivalya, the aloneness or solitude of Purusha. The following passage from Larson exemplifies an interpreter trying without success to see the soteriological relevance of the Samkhya categories. Samkhya's theory of evolution has very little to do with the problem of salvation, since in any given life, evolution is already accomplished before that particular life begins. But why then, asks Larson, does the Samkhya-karika discuss the problem of the functioning of the individual in the context of evolution or emergence? One possible answer, he continues, is that each successive life somehow recapitulates the original process of emergence. But such a doctrine of recapitulation is nowhere set forth in Samkhya-karika. Clearly, the exposition of the Samkhya-karika on this point leaves much to be desired. Larson here briefly toys with a version of the duplication thesis, speculating that the coming into being of each of us as a distinct person might, according to Samkhya, recapitulate some primordial impersonal process. But he appears, I think rightly, to dismiss this speculation on textual grounds. I take it that what Larson is puzzled about is not simply why Samkhya provides an inventory of categories, for the reason why it does so would seem to be fairly obvious. If the spiritual goal of Samkhya practitioners is to stop misidentifying themselves with everything that falls into the broad category of prakriti, then the rationale for providing an inventory or taxonomy of what falls into this broad category seems evident. It enables the practitioner to discern those things that are not to be identified with. Thus, I take it that what puzzles Larson is why a text such as the Samkhya-karika should devote so much attention to elaborating the precise sequence of the categories. In other words, why should it matter, soteriologically speaking, which of the categories manifested before which? Radhakrishnan too expresses this worry when he writes of its being, quote, difficult to understand the precise significance of the Samkhya account of evolution, end quote, and notes that he has, quote, not seen any satisfactory explanation as to why the different steps of evolution are what they are, end quote. Both Larson and Radhakrishnan are thus forced to conclude that the Samkhya-karika has simply left the point of its account of evolution unexplicated. While the Samkhya-karika undoubtedly poses some interpretive difficulties, the task of understanding it is hindered, I think, by certain presuppositions that are evident in interpretations such as those of Larson and Radhakrishnan. In the remainder of this paper, I want to question those presuppositions and to propose an alternative direction that brings out a greater degree of coherence in the Samkhya system. Even when interpreters of Samkhya abandon the cosmological construal of its categories in favour of a largely psychological one, they frequently bring to their interpretation two major presuppositions. which lead inevitably to the sort of bemusement displayed by Larson and Radhakrishna. One presupposition is that the relations between the manifest categories are diachronic, in the sense that buddhi emerges from unmanifest prakriti at a time earlier than ahankara, ahankara emerges earlier than the group of 16, which in turn emerge earlier than the five buddhas, whose source is the five tanmatras. The relations of dependency between the Sankhya categories need not, however, be construed in diachronic terms. Indeed, the system of categories makes a great deal more sense, I will suggest, if the relations are understood synchronically. The other presupposition is that a psychological interpretation of the manifest categories entails that they be regarded as psychological faculties. In the case of some of the categories, such a view gains support from the most literal meanings of the relevant Sanskrit terms. For example, indriya, which occurs as part of the compound terms buddhi-indriya and karma-indriya, is aptly translated as capacity, which has considerable semantic overlap with the notion of faculty. But there is no necessity to regard buddhi, ahankara or manas as faculties, and the danger in doing so is that a presumption may be created that the manifest categories constitute a kind of Cartesian ego or ghostly being, which in some sense inhabits the physical body. Maybe such interpretations aren't completely awry, but I don't mean to rule them out entirely, but I do want to make conceptual space for an alternative psychological interpretation of the categories, one which sees them as the result not of analysing the faculties of a putative, non-physical or subtle being, but of analysing experience and thereby determining the constitutive conditions of experience in general. I want to highlight and at least begin to develop a line of thinking that has been broached but not fully worked out by a small number of previous interpreters. Richard King alludes to this line of thinking when, after remarking that the Sankhya scheme can be interpreted both in psychological and cosmological terms, he elaborates the notion of a psychological interpretation by noting that, quote, the 25 tattvas can be seen as a conceptual map of the basic categories of experience, an analytic picture, if you like, of what you're actually experiencing now. The proposal that the categories constitute a picture of what one is actually experiencing now could be misleading, since it implies a level of detail and particularity that is not present in the Sankhya schema. But the central point, that a psychological interpretation of the categories can view them as a conceptual map of the basic categories of experience, deserves closer attention. A few interpreters have taken the suggestion that Sankhya is analysing experience and combined it with a grasp of the methods deployed by certain Western philosophers, especially phenomenologists such as Edmund Husserl. For example, Jagnishwar Ghosh, writing in the 1930s, implicitly invokes the Husserlian notion of bracketing questions concerning the ontological status of experiential phenomena when he says of Sankhya that it makes no question about the existence of a reality beyond the presentation continuum in us, or of a principle behind it to which it owes its solidarity. At the same time, since analytical reflection is brought to bear primarily on the contents of consciousness, there is no great leap from thought to things in themselves. The point that Ghosh makes here is insightful but also mystifying. It is insightful insofar as it emphasises the possibility of regarding the Sankhya categories as the result of analytical reflection upon the contents of consciousness. Yet it is mystifying insofar as it implies that the Sankhya system has no place for a reality beyond the presentation continuum. This is surprising because it seems that Sankhya does have a place for such a reality, namely avyakta or unmanifest prakriti, which could very well be described as a principle to which the continuum of experience owes its solidarity. Thus, if we are to attribute to Sankhya a proto-phenomenological method, this needs to be supplemented by noting that Sankhya appears also to have engaged in a form of transcendental reflection in roughly the Kantian sense. That is, reflection not only upon the basic constituents of experience, but, Parche Ghosh's interpretation, upon the metaphysical or transcendental preconditions of experience as well. This Kantian dimension to Samkhya's philosophical project has been suggested by, for example, J.N. Mohanty, who remarks that, quote, one may make sense of the Samkhya order of evolution by invoking some parts of Kantian epistemology. Yet Mohanty makes this suggestion only in passing, without pausing to elaborate it. My proposal is that we take seriously these suggestions from the likes of Mohanty and Ghosh, and consider whether a more internally coherent and soteriologically relevant interpretation of the Samkhya categories can be developed when certain aspects of Kantian and phenomenological philosophy are borne in mind. A useful starting point for such an interpretation is to suppose Samkhya's categorical schema to be a response to a question of the following form. What is the basic structure of experience, and what are its underlying necessary conditions? Addressing the first part of this question requires close attention to experience itself, accompanied by a process of rational abstraction, in order to derive a manageable inventory of general constitutive features of experience. Addressing the second part, namely the question of the necessary conditions of experience, requires the form of reasoning that Kant called transcendental reflection. Although it may be anachronistic to apply this latter expression to the methods of Samkhya philosophers, when we examine the 25 categories of Samkhya ontology, what we find is a system of interrelated principles that does indeed resemble what we might expect from a form of philosophizing that combines the two aspects I have mentioned, namely, firstly, the classification of general features of experience, and secondly, reflection upon their necessary but non-empirical conditions. In order to bring out this point more fully, we need to say more about the particular categories themselves. So let us examine the 23 manifest categories that are outlined in the Samkhya Karika. Starting with buddhi, this is defined in the Samkhya Karika as adhyavasaya, a term that also features in the Samkhya Karika's definition of perception, drishta. Adhyavasaya is often rendered as ascertainment or determination, and in my own translation of the text, I opted for discernment. Heinrich Zimmer lists its possible meanings as determination, resolution, mental effort, awareness, feeling, opinion, belief, knowledge, discrimination, and decision, thereby indicating the breadth of buddhi's significance. Buddhi is said to have a lucid or sattvika aspect and a dark or tamasa aspect, the former comprising virtuous qualities or propensities, and the latter comprising their opposites. Later in the Samkhya Karika, these qualities or dispositions are referred to as bhavas, a term that covers all 50 of the psychological categories that constitute Samkhya's pratyaya sarga. The upshot of all this is that buddhi, in the context of Samkhya, is a broad-ranging term signifying the sphere of human psychological dispositions and states in general, but with an emphasis on those states that involve awareness of some phenomenal content. Hence the close association with perception. If forced to select one English term to capture the gist of the concept of buddhi, I would opt for intentional consciousness, where intentional is used in the sense derived from phenomenology to mean consciousness of or about or directed towards something. Phenomenologists such as Brentano, Husserl, and Sartre have deemed intentionality to be the hallmark of consciousness as such, on the grounds that all consciousness is consciousness of something. Samkhya demurs from this view insofar as its conception of spiritual liberation consists in Purusha's isolation from all experiential content, and this appears to amount to a conception of a state of pure, contentless consciousness, the abiding of the seer in its own form, as the Yoga Sutra puts it. One way of characterizing the relation between Purusha and Buddhi, then, is to say that Buddhi is the form of consciousness that is instantiated when Purusha is presented with the experienceable matter, with any experienceable matter. This, on my view, is what proponents of Sankhya mean when they speak of Buddhi emerging out of the coming together or samyoga of Purusha and Prakriti. Unmanifest Prakriti, we might say, is the transcendental source of objectivity, and Purusha is the transcendental source of subjectivity. It is only in conjunction with one another that experience, that is, any form of intentional consciousness whatsoever, can occur. Thus, when the Yoga Sutra, for example, states that all objects result from the colouring or parakta of consciousness, citta, in the seer and the seeable, by the seer and the seeable, sorry, this can be interpreted to mean that objectual or intentional consciousness is the product of samyoga. This interpretation in no way implies that there was a time at which Purusha and Prakriti existed in isolation from one another, at a moment temporally prior to the emergence of Buddhi. All it implies is that, on the basis of transcendental reflection, Sankhya has inferred the necessity of Purusha and Prakriti as necessary conditions of experience. The analysis can be construed as synchronic rather than diachronic. The second manifest principle, ahankara, is defined in the Sankhya-karaka as abhimana, which in an ethical context can denote pride or self-conceit. In the context of Sankhya's analysis of experience, it is best understood as self-consciousness, in the sense that of one's being aware of oneself as a conscious subject. The term ahankara itself has been translated as self-consciousness by Jar and self-awareness by Larson, and other translations include individuation and my own egoity. It has been proposed by Van Buitenen, correct pronunciation of his name?
No, from Buitenen. It's from Buitenen.
Buitenen.
But you don't have to pronounce it the Dutch way.
Okay. It has been proposed by Van Buitenen that this concept has its origin, quote, in the ancient Upanishadic speculations on a self-formulating, self-creating primordial personality, end quote, whose verbal pronouncement, aham, or I, constitutes his self-creation, which in turn brings forth the cosmos. Van Buitenen notes that the distinction, quote, between macrocosmos and microcosmos is not firmly in place within the texts to which he is referring, most notably the Brihadaranyaka and Chandogya Upanishads, thereby implicitly allowing for a microcosmic or psychological level of interpretation. One possible interpretation would be to see the sense of egoity or selfhood as a necessary condition for the coming into being of a world, in the sense that without a sense of self, there could be no distinction between subject and object, and without this latter distinction, there could not be any objects at all. From this interpretive viewpoint, sense can be made of Sankhya's claim that the emergence of the remaining manifest categories proceeds, pravartate, from ahankara. The capacities for action and sensory experience, along with the five modes of sensory content, the tanmatras, can be understood to proceed from ahankara, in the sense that it is only a self-aware being that can perform actions and have sensory experience, and can have the experience of performing actions. While the claim that self-consciousness is necessary for experience and action may be philosophically contentious, it is at least an intelligible position, and it is one that other philosophers have held. In this respect, it contrasts with the standard interpretations according to which ahankara somehow materially transforms into, or otherwise generates out of itself, a range of organs or faculties and subtle elements. according to an experience-oriented interpretation, then, the first two categories of manifest property can be thought of as, firstly, the general form of consciousness, namely intentional consciousness, or buddhi, and secondly, the sense of, or at least potentiality for, self-awareness, ahamkara. The 16 further categories that are contingent upon ahamkara are divided into 11 sattvika ones and 5 tamasa ones, with all 16 being in some way affected or informed by tejas, the quality of fiery energy or activity. Although it is not entirely clear what is signified here by these associations with the 3 gunas, namely sattva, tamas and rajas, or in this case tejas, a speculation in the light of phenomenological thought might be the following. The capacities for sensation and action are sattvika, or lucid, in the sense that it is through them that consciousness of sensory phenomena is attained. They illuminate or bring to light the sensory material that gives content to experience, which is why they are termed doors, dwaras, at Sankhya-karika 35. That's the tattvas in the white block on the left-hand side there. They're termed dwaras at Sankhya-karika 35. The tanmatras, by contrast, are tamasa, dull or opaque, in the sense that they are the very material that the senses bring to consciousness. The 5 tanmatras, though not individually named in Sankhya-karika, are agreed by classical commentators to be the 5 modes of sensory content, a point that can easily be obscured when tanmatra is translated as subtle element or material essence. The tanmatras are subtle only in as much as they are the intentional content of sensory experience, as opposed to being physical objects. They are respectively the sound, shabda, that is heard when hearing something, the tactile feeling, sparsha, that is felt when touching something, the form, rupa, that is seen when seeing something, the flavour, rasa, that is tasted when tasting something, and the odour, gandha, that is smelt when smelling something. What generates problems for many interpreters is the assumption that the tanmatras must be material entities that occupy some intermediary ontological position between the psychological domain of buddhi, ahamkara and manas and the domain of physical matter supposedly constituted by the buddhas. In particular, when the buddhas are assumed to be something like atomic particles that compose physical objects, then it is also assumed that the production of the buddhas must involve a process in which the tanmatras somehow congeal or condense into them. Thus, Eliade writes, by a process of condensation that tends to produce structures increasingly gross, these tanmatras give rise to atoms, paramanu, and molecules, stula bhutani, literally dense material particle, which in turn give birth to vegetable organisms, vriksha, and animal organisms, sharira. Many commentators, like Eliade, appear not to see much difficulty in the suggestion that dense material particles are produced from a condensation of sound, tactile sensation, or visual form, etc., which in turn are purported to be produced from self-consciousness or self-awareness. The difficulty of making such a conception intelligible is largely concealed by the use of terms such as subtle and gross, which enable interpreters to overlook the particularities of the various manifest categories and to assume the emergence of the categories to be, as Anima Sengupta has put it, quote, simply the passage from the subtle to the gross. On the experience-oriented interpretation that I'm proposing, Prakriti's manifestation or creative emergence is not the evolution of a series of material entities from more refined to more coarse or dense. Rather, it is the emergence of experience itself in all its manifest variety, with the categories being more or less abstract principles derived from an analysis of that manifold variety. The Buddhas, which are so often construed as material particles, need not be interpreted in this way. Instead, they can be thought of as the states of being of material objects, or the forms taken by those objects in our experience. Such an interpretation gains credibility, or some credibility at least, from its close affinity with how the Buddhas or Mahabuddhas are commonly understood in other traditions, such as Abhidharma Buddhism. Herbert Guenther, writing in the Buddhist writing of the Buddhist Mahabuddhas, notes that there are four such great elementary qualities: earth, water, fire, and air basis. Earth is the symbolic expression for all that is solid and able to carry a load, water for all that is fluid and cohesive, fire for all that is light and moving. The Mahabuddhas collectively constitute the category of rupa, that is, form or appearance. And as other commentators on early Buddhism have noted, the emphasis here is on the appearance of physical objects in conscious experience, rather than on a world that is supposed to exist independently of conscious beings. Now, it's possible that's a controversial reading of Abhidharma Buddhism, and I'm no scholar of that area of Indian philosophy, but I've noted that as a pretty well substantiated interpretation by some other scholars. Rupert Geffin, for example. Of course, the fact that terms are understood in a particular way within early Buddhism does not entail that these meanings carry over into classical Samkhya. However, when a term has a reasonably well-established use in one tradition, and that use makes better sense within another tradition than do alternative interpretations, then there are strong grounds for presuming that the same use does indeed obtain within both traditions, I would submit. This, I maintain, is the case with the use of the terms Mahabuddha and Buddha in Abhidharma Buddhism and classical Samkhya respectively. In each of these traditions, the notion of forms taken by physical objects in perceptual experience is the interpretation that is both most intelligible in itself and most congruent with the overall orientation of the system concerned. The interpretation of the Samkhya categories for which I've been arguing can be summarised in a diagram such as this one, similar to one that I showed previously. On the face of it, the formal representation of the relations between the various categories may not appear to differ much from how they are depicted in standard accounts. The crucial difference is that in standard versions, the arrows connecting the categories typically indicate the direction of diachronic evolution or material causality, whereas here, on my account, they indicate what might be termed the direction of synchronic conditionality or dependency. For example, buddhi need not be understood as coming into being at a moment temporally prior to its giving rise to or evolving into ahankara. Rather, buddhi as intentional consciousness can be understood as the necessary condition for the differentiation between subject and object, and the recognition of oneself as a subject, which is captured by the term ahankara. This self-recognition, or self-formulation, as Van Boutenen puts it, can in turn be understood as the necessary condition for the relation of the relating of imaginative and sensory experience, and also bodily activity, to oneself, and hence for the range of categories designated by the terms manas, buddhindriya, karmendriya, tanmatra, and bhuta. The tanmatras, or modes of sensory content, are necessary conditions for the bhutas, in the sense that, in the absence of sensory information, we could not have any perception of objects as solid, fluid, bright or hot, moving, or spatially located. But again, the relation of conditionality is not one that involves material causation or evolution. Sensory information does not generate physical objects in the sense of causing them to come into being, yet it might well be construed as enabling objects to become present to consciousness, and hence to manifest as constituents of our experience. Thus, on this latter interpretation, Sankhya's doctrine of transformation, the Parinamavada, for which it is well known, can be regarded as a doctrine of one thing's providing the conditions for another thing's becoming manifest to consciousness. And Sankhya's schema of 25 categories can be regarded not as a creation myth, but as a systematic analysis of experience. Finally, a brief word needs to be said about the relevance of Sankhya's analysis to its goal of liberation from dissatisfaction and distress. According to Sankhya-karika II, the superior method of attaining this goal is to discriminate between the manifest, the unmanifest, and the one who knows, the jnana. And for the one who knows, namely Purusha, to stop misidentifying with property in either its manifest or unmanifest aspect. This is accomplished by means of the procedure referred to at Karaka 64 as Tattva Akhyasa, literally the practice of thatness, or less literally, the practice of discerning the categories, where the categories in question are precisely those which constitute Sankhya's analysis of experience. It is reasonable to assume that the context for this practice is the kind of sustained sitting meditation characteristic of classical yoga, wherein thought and sensory stimulation are reduced to a bare minimum in order that the underlying structure of experience can be contemplated. Within this meditative context, the practitioner of Sankhya focuses attention upon distinct categories and reflects upon their transcendental conditions. I'm speculating. The categorical schema acts, as Richard King noted, as a conceptual map, enabling the practitioner to recognize the constitutive features of experience as playing no part in his or her ultimate identity as Purusha. The order in which the Sankhya-karika presents the categories, which so bemused Radhakrishnan and Larson, appears to be one of diminishing levels of abstraction. At the final end of the sequence are the buttas, these being relatively discernible characteristics of perceptual phenomena, whereas at the beginning is buddhi, which is experience conceived in the most abstract of terms as mere awareness of something. It is in this sense that buddhi is the most subtle and the buttas the most dense or gross of the manifest categories. Whether the final goal of Sankhya and Yoga, the purported abiding of pure consciousness in its own form, is really an intelligible notion, is, I think, questionable. But this is not an issue that can be explored here in this paper. What I hope to have provided in this paper are plausible suggestions as to how the Sankhya categories can be understood. I've argued that they need be construed neither as the result of cosmological speculation, nor as an imaginative account of how a series of psychological faculties came into existence. Instead, they can be understood as the result of a method that involves both rigorous attention to the structure of experience and a form of philosophizing analogous to Kantian transcendental reflection. When understood in this way, the relevance of Sankhya's system of categories to its soteriological aspiration is able to emerge.
Okay, so we'll open it up. Shall
we? I'm kind of, largely in sympathy with what you're trying to do in this paper. But my question was, if you read the ablative as a kind of necessary condition and your arrows as a necessary condition, then I'm puzzled about why the sattvic on the left and the tamasa on the right run in parallel. But surely the five sense capacities are necessary conditions for the five modes of sense content. So there ought to be a kind of an arrow going from the left to the right there.
I suppose the way I would interpret the structure here is that have seeing without something to be seen. And you can't have hearing without something to hear, and so on. So they go in tandem, and they can't have one without the other, hence they come into being simultaneously, as it were, or they're both conditional upon the sort of prior condition of egoity, but neither of them is prior in terms of conditionality or dependency. They're dependent,
okay.
They're sort of mutually dependent, they're
uh-huh.
dependent on one another, that's how I'd see it.
Okay.
I was just curious, when we speak of experience in Sankhya, then is it the experience of Prakriti or the experience of Purusha? Because in the last few texts of the Sankhya Gayakas, Isha Krishna writes how liberation entails one Prakriti or one Buddhi realizing that it's actually part of the other Prakriti or Buddhi. And the Purusha itself doesn't will or desire or act in any way. So, does the Purusha experience at all in Sankhya?
Mm. No, I think it's a difficult question because you know there are some contexts in which Purusha is referred to as the experiencer or the Bhokta, I think is the Sanskrit. That can be translated as experiencer. Sort of the ultimate experiencer, as it were, and that ordinarily when we're engaging in everyday activities, we take ourselves to be the experiencer, but really we're identifying with something that isn't the ultimate experiencer. But on the way that I've read the system here, buddhi is the experiencer, or it's the experience that we might describe as an experience of something, hence it's everything that we would ordinarily regard as experience, and yet it's not, still buddhi is not the ultimate source of subjectivity. Now I'm fudging it a bit there, not saying, I don't want to say not the ultimate experiencer, but somehow not the ultimate source of experience. So the way I see it is that you can't have any experience of something, you can't have any intentional consciousness without Purusha and Prakriti. So if the ultimate goal is for Purusha to in some sense isolate itself, then it can't have experience of anything in the ultimate state, in Kaivalya. What is Kaivalya? I think that all the texts kind of break down into incoherence at that point where they try to say anything positive about it, which is why they typically characterize it in negative terms as being the cessation of both misidentification with sort of prakritic aspects of being, and also this, on my interpretation, that entails the cessation of any experience of anything. Does it entail the cessation of consciousness in some nebulous sense of pure contentless consciousness, which I personally can't make sense of? No, I don't think so. I think if we read the texts. Yoga Sutra, Sankhya Karika, for example, it certainly comes across that what they're aiming for is a state of pure contentless consciousness, even if I think that's an unintelligible notion, that's how they put it.
Yes, I appreciate what you're saying, and I think I sort of buy it in a way. There seem to me to be some parallels with Jainism here, or at least with the Jains, and you've got a dualism there in Jainism as well between, essentially dualism between matter and what's non-material, spirit. But Jainism avoids some of these problems because it's got problems of its own. It avoids the problem of having to explain how things evolve because it has no creation. And in a way, it's a synchronism, I think, in your terms. The Jains, I suppose, on the whole, when they challenge about, how does this work, they default precisely to experience. They say, this is the way we experience the world. Somehow this non-material jiva, soul, is implicated in matter, and we've got to deal with that. And in ways, is that the approach you're taking here? That this is about experience, and so it's a given in a way. Yes.
That's exactly how I'm reading this system. That experience is the starting point, and the project is to analyse experience. And I suppose one could see it talking in soteriological terms. Experience is not only the given and the starting point, but it's the problem. You know, there's something ultimately dissatisfactory about experience, and this is explicitly stated in the opening karakara of the Sankhya Karakara, that philosophy comes about as a consequence of dukkha. You know, the existence of dukkha prompts us into a philosophical enterprise. And I mean, that's not unique to Sankhya, and I think there's going to be some close similarities with Jainism and other systems here. So, short answer is yeah, that's how I'm seeing it.
I have actually three questions, but they are not necessarily that long. I have also a lot of sympathy with trying to outline this in terms of the human experience. But there are problems arising. For example, you translate buddhi as intentional consciousness. Could you then explain what you mean by meditation?
Right. Oh, do you want to pause there? Yeah, okay. Meditation. I mean, manas is often, as you know, translated mind. And meditation is my attempt to get away from that. It's my attempt to get away from the temptation to think of it as an entity. There might not be anything ultimately problematic about conceiving of this as an entity, but I think we should at least, this is how I want to put it, we should at least be open to other possibilities that might make a bit more sense of the system. And so meditation is a process or an activity, or it might be the content of that process or activity. Meditation is either, we can think of meditation either as what we do when we think, or sort of as an activity, like meditating. I'm not sure that's a verb, but or we can think of it as the content of what I'm having when I'm thinking, when I'm undergoing thinking processes. I think that's a key part of what manas stands for, that kind of activity of thinking. But I think it's more than, I think it's more than that. But I translate the term as meditation in order to keep some sort of acknowledgement of the etymology. Clearly there is some etymological connection between manas and through the Latin to English term mind and the mental. And so I'm trying to just keep in tune with that etymology and yet not provide the temptation for thinking of it as a Cartesian ego or mind.
But then, if we go back to Buddha, there is no doubt that the texts talk about Buddha in a cosmic context as well.
Which texts?
That brings me to my third point. Because you say often the texts, and you have so far referred only to the Sankhya Karika and the Yoga Sutras.
Yeah.
And okay, there is clearly a strong link between the two, or between Sankhya as a system and yoga as a system, if you like. But I think one shouldn't lose sight of the fact that Sankhya, as presented in the Sankhya Karika, is a system in flux. It has is not the earliest text of this system. It is the earliest fairly systematic presentation of it which is available to us. But there are early texts referred to in the Karikas themselves, And I think, in a sense, one loses track of, I mean, if you sort of array for the Sankhya Karika as the thing, then there are numerous commentaries on it, elaborations on it within the Indian tradition itself. And some of the most valuable interpretations I think you find in texts such as the Yukti Deepika, which is one such text, but also in other Sankhya texts like the Sankhya Prachanabhasya, for example, or other commentaries like Martara's commentary, the Jayamangala, and so on. So, I mean, there is a whole Sankhya universe, if you like. That is my point, that it's somewhat difficult to try to squeeze everything out of the Sankhya Karika.
May I add, if I can permit?
Yeah, that's fine.
Because the text you mentioned, the Yukti Deepika and the Sankhya Prachanabhasya and some others, they actually show awareness of the very problem you have discussed today.
Mm-hmm.
And they come up with solutions. So you talk as if the problem is the problem of us understanding something like Indian philosophy, but the Indian philosophers who commented this text and who knew other texts, they were aware of the problem, addressed it, and solved it in ways different from yours. Now, that is the text that followed the Sankhya Karika. As Ivan said already, we know, thanks to philological detailed research, a fair bit about Sankhya before the Sankhya Karika. And your presentation, again, seems to take it as if the author of this text, Ishvara Krishna, on his own, developed a philosophy. Well, he didn't. We know from the Mahabharata that many of these terms were already in wide use in more or less vague context. We know from the Shashti Tantra and the numerous quotations from this text that attempts were made to create something more coherent than what we find in the Sankhya Karika, and to take this short text completely out of its historical context and only compare it with what a few modern people think about it, I find it a little bit risky.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, thanks.
I think it continues a bit with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's certainly on the same lines, yeah. Yes, I mean, no, I think it's a reasonable criticism that I don't make a great deal of reference to the commentarial literature. I mean, the talk that I've presented is it's pretty much the paper that I've written for this conference, and that paper is largely a summary of a larger sort of research project that I undertook as a PhD, and I looked at the commentaries. Now, I'd be very interested if you've got any references for where you think the very problem that I'm discussing.
Actually, I wrote a paper about this very topic, which I paid your attention 10 years ago as well.
It may not have done. What was the paper? Your paper?
It was called the. I have the title here somewhere. The Contradiction of Sankhya.
Yeah, I mean, I've read it. But I mean, I can't remember the details. I've undertaken an extensive look at the secondary literature and the commentarial literature. And no, I mean, yeah, maybe some things have escaped my attention. Maybe I've misread some of the commentarial material. But I didn't see it as addressing the question in quite a way. But I'll certainly have another look at your paper, and this will undoubtedly embellish and support my thinking on these issues. There's a methodological point that you're questioning the method that I've employed, which I don't like to be accused of, but I can see the legitimacy of the criticism that I'm taking something out of context. I'm to some extent taking it out of historical context. But on the other hand, we have to give ourselves manageable projects. And speaking personally, I found it extremely
interesting and rewarding to ask the question, what is, how can this this apparently sort of ontological system be made more coherent and or be interpreted in a way that suggests that it already is coherent, and also relevant to the soteriological enterprise. And I didn't see that kind of coherence and relevance within the existing secondary literature that I was looking at, and I didn't find much to help me within the commentaries. What I found was various elaborations of the original text in the commentaries, but elaborations that themselves required interpretation, and so I was needing to bring my own interpretive, maybe some presuppositions, but I was required to bring my own interpretive resources and skills to the commentarial literature. And so it was difficult to see how I could somehow arrive at a more authentic interpretation of the original merely through the commentaries. It was still me doing the interpreting. So I didn't see any way around it. And so I could make more references to the commentarial literature in the paper, but I'm not sure what purpose it would serve. It would show that, look, here are what some commentators have said about the text, and here's my interpretation of what those commentators are saying. And it could well add extra layers of complication to an already quite complicated thesis. So they were just some of my kind of pragmatic reasons for not bringing in lots of references to commentaries in the paper. I make more references to commentaries in sort of footnotes and stuff in the book that was based on my PhD thesis, and that this is largely a condensation of. But thanks for the, thanks for asking. Maybe, could I just comment on the fact that I haven't brought in earlier, pre-Sankhya sources? I mean, for similar reasons, that it's going to complicate the thesis a great deal more, and maybe that's not a bad thing. Sometimes simple theses can be dubious and misleading for that very reason. But, what significance is it that these terms were already in existence? Well, it's of some significance, and I make reference to, for example, Bautanen's interpretation of the sort of origins of the term Ahamkara. He's engaged in a kind of historico-archaeological enterprise, looking through the Upanishads for early references to the term, and bringing that to his understanding of classical Sankhya. And I do somewhat the same, but in this paper, that's about the only place where I've done it. But I'm up for that. It's occasionally where it's appropriate, looking at earlier uses of particular terms, concepts, in order to enhance one's understanding of how it was used in the classical text. But this paper is, I think it's disingenuous on the part of Ivind and maybe lesser extent both of you to sort of criticise me for not covering the whole historical trajectory of Sankhya, because this paper is entitled The Analysis of Experience in Classical Sankhya.
Okay, let's forget about criticising, and perhaps we can continue the debate without implication of criticism or otherwise. But if you situate Sankhya thinkers in a tradition, then the next Sankhya thinker, he had his list in something like the forum you have on the board. He had to deal with that, whether he liked it or not. That is, he had to make some sense of that. Not just by interpreting the words individually. There is one attempt, which I have documented, to interpret the whole list in the following way. As you know, Prakriti is one and omnipresent. And in the pre-Sankhya Karika end, which is not in the Sankhya Karika, but is attested by 4, 5, 6 different authors, the Sankhya thought of the gunas of the elements as the end, because substances were thought of as guna samudaya. I think that's the term that people like Dignani used to describe a Sankhya position, which you don't find in the Sankhya Karika. And then, a number of remarks may believe that there was one Sankhya thinker in the row who had his whole list. He had to live with it, somehow he had to incorporate it, and he interpreted as Prakriti being omnipresent, and each next state being a subdivision, until at the end you had the ultimate constituent of matter, which in his case were the gunas. Now, right or wrong, it shows the main point I wish to make. A Samkhya thinker, if he belongs to the tradition, does not invent a new philosophy, or at best he makes the best he can of something that tradition has offered him, for better or for worse from our point of view. So if we forget his constraints and we all of a sudden start looking anew at his whole list, then whose thoughts we are interpreting becomes a bit obscure.
Mm-hmm.
Does it make any sense?
Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Certainly a different question. Certainly your sort of, let's say, experiential mode of how to interpret this kind of category in some ways gives better sense how to connect this category enumeration to sociological concern, and that's very valid point. But it's just the as I kind of focus on my study of Vedanta, the way sort of Vedanta usually describes Sankhya is sometimes in relationship to Satkaryavada, which is to me very much like a cosmological or cosmogonical interpretation of Sankhya from which you're kind of trying to get away with. So I'm just, my question is, would you say this Sankhya as a Satkaryavada kind of interpretation is, from your perspective, kind of missing the point?
So the question is,
did the Vedantins get it wrong?
Because
either you're right or they're right. That's
because they're construing Satkaryavada in a particular way. Yeah.
To be sure.
Well, I mean, it'd be very arrogant of me to say that they got it wrong. I mean, I'm trying not to phrase things in those ways. You know, maybe I'm fudging it a little bit by saying, look, here's a possible interpretation that seems to make sense of the system, but I think that's as strong as I can put it. And if it, you know, if as you say, there are other ways of reading particular, you know, key technical concepts, let's say Satkarya, you know, the expression Satkaryavada doesn't occur within the Satkarika, but Satkarya certainly does. Yes, it's a tricky one, and I struggle, given the resources that we've got, both within the Sankhya and what commentators say about it. I struggle to make it fully intelligent to myself, and to be honest, I haven't sort of refreshed my understanding of that concept for the purposes of this paper a while since I gave much careful thought to it, so I'm not sort of prepared at the moment to try to elaborate my understanding of the concept, but I do see. Given the rest of my interpretation, I'd be forced to try to interpret it either as an incongruity and hence not supportive of my interpretation at all, or I'd be forced to see it in some sense of this sort of conditions of one thing. So sort of X being the case being conditioned by Y being the case, and so on, in a synchronic sense. Rather than material causation, I certainly wouldn't see it as.
Right,
and hence I don't feel that it forces one into a cosmological interpretation at all.
Well, but then I think in Vedantic context, it's definitely at least as far as.
Yeah, there'll be a further question there, which I don't think you can ask, Mikhail, which will be to say, is reading the Satkaryavada necessarily cosmogonical?
Thank you. I'm a bit reluctant, so late in the day, to say something, but I thought
this, I think Sankhya is absolutely fascinating. I come at it from the point of view of an Indo-European cultural comparativist, so in a way I'm going even beyond what Eivind and Johannes were saying, that we need to situate it in a very long time span, I think. Within the Indo-European domain, I've been particularly interested in pentadic structures, building on Humezil, who was interested in triads, but I think his scheme was much too narrow. You need five. And so Sankhya naturally attracted me, and I also looked a bit at the elements from this point of view. In order to make a link with what you were saying, do you think it's significant that Sankhya is built on five times five, as well as, I mean, you've got two levels of pentad, haven't you? You've got the four sets of five that you've got there, but you've also got five compartments, as it were, in your diagram. You've got the four sets of five quite clearly, and then you've got the rest above at the top. Do you think this structure is significant, and if so, how would you interpret it?
Short answer would be no. I don't see so much significant. Well, yes and no. I think that would be the short answer. And then I'll try to elaborate that. Certainly, the numbering five is significant within the system. But I see its significance as deriving primarily from the Buddhendriya category, the fact that we have five sense modalities or five senses. And five tanmatras corresponding to those five sense modalities, they that sort of follows quite neatly. Then, but as for the Karamendriyas, the Buddhas, I mean, there's been a here looking at the tradition would be relevant because there's a long tradition, and I sort of alluded to alternative construals of the Buddhas within previous traditions, but I alluded to the Abhidharma Buddhism, where actually they only have four, so that might be a little misleading. But anyway, we'd have to look at the tradition as to come up with reasons why there would be five of those. Within Sankhya, one rather, perhaps slightly crude, maybe a little cynical, quick speculation would be that it provides symmetry to the system, and you know, maybe aesthetic motivations are driving that. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is that I see the five Buddhendriyas and the five Tanmatras as the primary generators of the fivefold kind of scheme. And where my answer would be no, that I don't see, it's not obvious to me what the significance would be, is the fact that there are five blocks of five. I don't know. And indeed, the three at the top there, I mean, you're making that five by adding unmanifest prakriti and purusha. Yeah. Well, I don't see a lot of significance in that fivefold scheme.
Okay, can we just say, I think, just one more question?
I have the same problem which was raised by Erwin Kass and Johannes, mm-hmm. and I share their concern. And I would suggest that even if you don't go to the whole trajectory of Sankhya literature, as you say, it will make it more complicated. At least you could have gone to one of the commentaries of Sankhya Karika.
Yeah.
At least one.
Mm-hmm.
For there are so many commentaries, Tattva Kaumudi is the easiest.
Yes, yes, yes.
And then there are many commentaries on Tattva Kaumudi itself.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have referred to so many modern scholars for translations,
yeah.
So at least you could have referred to one of the commentators.
Especially your puzzlement about nature of consciousness and so on. You go to the Tattva Kaumudi, you have a much later developed by the time some of the arguments about Prakashavadas and so on have taken forth. So some of your puzzlement would perhaps have been handled a little bit more in the later traditions.
I have a problem with this translation mentation. It will not be manas, it will be manana. As you said, the
yes,
process
yes.
of menting. It's not the manas organ.
Which Vasubandhu uses, for
yeah.
example.
So
if they want to, they can use manana.
Because you have referred to modern scholars quite often,
yeah.
I just wonder whether you have had a chance to see what Halbfass has written about Sankhya and Vaisheshika.
Yep.
That Sankhya model is a vertical model of evolution, while the Vaisheshika model is a horizontal
yep.
model.
Yep.
So, by any
that.
Chance, have you gone through it? And then
yeah.
what
no, he just rejects it. They're all wrong.
Yeah.
Hey, I don't just reject it. I reject it on.
No, no, you reject it.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
what I want your reaction to that. What he has suggested.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, I think the way he interprets the Vaisheshika system is quite instructive for how, for a possibility, you know, for an option of how the Sankhya system might be interpreted. And I think the reason that he's sort of contrasting them in that way is because he's accepting. A previous interpretation of the Sankhya system, which I'm questioning.
Yeah.
So I think he was of some assistance to me in that regard. Insofar as I thought, yes, look, here's a way of interpreting a system that might be construed diachronically or hierarchically as synchronic. So
mm-hmm.
yeah, that's his interpretation was of great interest to me there. Tatwakam would be yes, I. Again, I mean, I'd make the same answer, really, that I would need to be interpreting that text just as much as I was interpreting Sankhya Karaka. I've read the Tattva Kalmudi. I hope that I've taken that into account, but I haven't made that explicit enough. You know, that's
modern commentaries with Vatoshini, Sushama, and like that on Tattva Kalmudi.
Oh, now you're asking more.
No, but at least one. I said at least one you
yeah.
could have referred to.
Yeah,
that
but it's
would
just
have
that
saved so many problems. Yeah, because
well,
then you could have got some
that.
Chance to go to the interpreters, the traditional interpreters, what they have to say.
Yes, but then when you
when
say
you're
make some
reference, philosophy, that's the least one expects, isn't it? Some comment. The text that you have chosen is Sankhya Karika. So either Yukti Deepika or Tattva Kalmudi or.
But you mean at every step of my argument, you know, say
not
what,
every
what the
step, but at least at some point of time.
Okay.
That's the suggestion. It's up to you.
Okay.
Could I just say one very quick word in defense of McCann on this point? Because I think that this appeal to commentaries and interpretative traditions can be completely overdone. You know, I mean, it used to be the case that people only ever read Aristotle through the whole medieval Aristotelian tradition. And now, you know, modern Greek philosophers read Aristotle and try and work out what Aristotle thought. And, you know, to try to read Plato only through the Neoplatonists, you'd get a completely misleading.
I think there is a framing problem.
I just wanted to ask Shashi Prabhu one more thing. You don't like my translation of Manas. What how do you translate
Manas? I said it's Manana. The translation that you have provided,
yeah.
it's not Manas.
Well, what's Manas?
Manana. Manas, I would write retain mind.
You prefer mind?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because in the specific sense of Sankhya, of course.
Well, I gave
yeah.
a reason for.
Yeah,
for
that's
not,
okay. But then mentation,
that.
As you yourself said, it is a process.
Okay.
But manas is not a process in Sankhya.
Okay.
That's my objection.
Obviously, lots of interesting fundamental issues. Yeah.
yeah.
Thank you very much, Mikhail.
Mm-hmm.